fluffy bread, fresh tortillas, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real. But Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and seriously, great taste. Made from a new recipe using heart-healthy olive oil and resistant wheat starch that acts as a prebiotic fiber to promote gut health, Hero Bread products have more of the dietary fiber and protein you want without the net carbs and sugar you don't. There's something for every craving. Sliced bread loaves, buns, and tortillas, plus monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites with no compromise. Like the 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HeroPod at HERO.CO.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
A loud noise awakened neighbors in a quiet Florida neighborhood in the middle of the night. Across the street, they watched as their neighbor pulled out of her driveway and moved slowly down the street in her black car. Moments later, a dull red glow burst into a bright orange flicker as flames shot through the windows of the home. By the time firefighters arrived, the blaze was raging. Not long before sunrise, as the final embers were snuffed out, investigators entered the partially scorched structure. It didn't take long to determine that the fire had been the result of arson, with obvious evidence that an accelerant had been used. While investigators were weighing the possibilities, another fire was called in. This one, 80 miles away, fully engulfed the vehicle of Dory Ann Myers, the woman whose home had been set alight hours earlier. Soon, detectives would learn a bizarre story about two men, allegedly wounded war veterans, who were seen with Dory in the hours leading up to her disappearance. Known to have a soft spot for soldiers, she may have offered them a place to stay and was repaid for her kindness with a violent abduction. However, some believe the story of the soldiers is little more than a cover designed to protect the person truly responsible for the single mother's disappearance and likely murder. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 213, The Disappearance of Dory Ann Myers. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the circumstances surrounding the mysterious 2006 disappearance of 43-year-old Dory Ann Myers. Before getting into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, episode breakdowns, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or by emailing me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. As one final note, this year, CrimeCon is taking place in Orlando, Florida, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. Over the last few years, I've had the privilege to meet and talk with so many listeners of the show, both new and original. Attending CrimeCon has become an annual tradition for me, and with each new year, it gets bigger and better. CrimeCon will be taking place from September 22nd to 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, and I'm really hoping to see you there. Whether you're thinking about attending your first CrimeCon or returning for another exciting year, you can save 10% on your pass by using the promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Save some cash, take a trip, and stop by Podcast Row to say hello. Visit CrimeCon.com and use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your pass today. 43-year-old Dory Ann Myers was a bright, hardworking woman with a wide circle of friends and a close family. One night in January, she mysteriously vanished as her home burst into flames. What happened to Dory, and who was responsible for this heinous crime? This is episode 213, The Disappearance of Dory Ann Myers. Four hours before the sun spilled its golden light up over the horizon, a dim glow began flaring to life in a quiet little neighborhood in eastern Florida. Neighbors, awakened by indistinct sounds, peered out their window and watched as a flickering orange light began growing in intensity behind the home across the street. Quickly reaching for the phone and dialing 911, they watched as the homeowner's car pulled out of the driveway and began slowly rolling down the street, disappearing around the corner just as the intensity of the glow behind the home began increasing rapidly, a nearly undetectable funnel of dark-colored smoke pouring out into the blackness of the early morning sky. Arriving less than 15 minutes later, the fire department pulled in to find flames bursting through the windows of the house and flaring up through the roof. Strangely, the fire itself seemed to be mostly localized to the back parts of the home. Firefighters got lines running and quickly began controlling the blaze. Within moments of the fire department arriving, so did patrol units from the local police. Neighbors, who had reported the blaze, quickly informed the officers that just moments before the fire, they had seen the homeowner's car driving away. They urged police to go after the woman, believing she may have left without noticing the fire. When the fire was finally snuffed out, much of the home was damaged from both water and smoke. Only a third of the house seemed to have been directly impacted by the flames, and it didn't take long for fire investigators to determine that this had been no accident. It was a clear-cut example of arson, as they would discover the fire had started in multiple places, and while they have never specified exactly what, some type of an accelerant was used. Initially, it was theorized that perhaps the homeowner, 43-year-old Dory Ann Myers, may have set the blaze herself, perhaps to gain insurance money, or maybe for another reason. While police began trying to track down Dory, her family was devastated to learn of the fire and her subsequent disappearance. While police were working from an angle in which they believed Dory may have been involved in the crime, her family were absolutely opposed to that possibility. That point would become somewhat moot, however, when just before sunrise, a fire department nearly 100 miles away received a call about a car fire. Dory's vehicle was found engulfed in flames, abandoned in the middle of nowhere by a rural boat launch near Lake Okeechobee. What had begun as a call about a house fire had, within hours, transformed into an arson investigation and the desperate search for a woman who may have been abducted by the person or persons who had set her home ablaze, killing her beloved pets, and destroying everything she'd spent a lifetime accumulating. Dory Ann Curry was born on Monday, September 3rd, 1962, in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, to parents Dale and Esther. Dory would be the baby of the family, coming along after the birth of her brother, Dale Jr., and her sister, Donna Jean. Friends and family have described Dory as being a smart, caring, and fun-loving person who was never afraid of a challenge and always maintained a fiercely independent mindset. Though born in her father's native Ohio, Dory was raised in Florida and would go on to spend the vast majority of her life living on the sunny peninsula. She would go on to attend Vero Beach High School, performing well academically and developing a wide circle of friends. Dory never struggled much when it came to making and keeping friends, with many describing her as full of fun and excitement, with a love of laughter and a warm and welcoming nature. Set to graduate in 1980, that year would bring more than just a diploma into Dory's life as her first and only child, Jesse, was born in March. Dory had met and fallen in love with Ricky King, a man 6 years her senior who, at the time, was working at Piper Aircraft, where Dory's father had worked for many years. According to everyone who knew Dory during this time, the relationship between the two was a happy one, and Dory was very open about the fact that she viewed Ricky as her soulmate, the one true love of her life. Tragically, their time together would be cut short in December of 1982 when Ricky and a close friend passed away from carbon monoxide poisoning due to a leak in their apartment building. At the time of Ricky's death, both he and Dory are listed in public records as living in Baytown, Texas, a city in the southeast of the state not far from the Louisiana border. It appears that, following Ricky's passing, Dory made the decision to return to Florida, where she would live out the remainder of her life. She devoted herself to her son, wanting to do the best she could to raise him. While being interviewed on the podcast Unfound, hosted by Ed Dentzel, Dory's sister, Donna Jean, explained that Dory was a fun mother, but a tough one. She considered it a matter of high importance to instill in her son the needs to be self-reliant and independent. Unfortunately, while Dory was seeking out stability and reliability, her relationships oftentimes led in the opposite direction. In the time following Ricky's death, some have speculated that Dory might have felt somewhat alone or concerned about the challenges of trying to be a single mother. This, they believe, may have led to her engaging in relationships with men where there was a slim likelihood of a long-term dedicated union. She would marry and divorce two more times over the next decade. First, to Glenn Burkhart, married in 85 and divorced in 86. Then to Stephen Myers, with their marriage lasting not much longer than the previous one had. According to Donna Jean, none of the men in Dory's life could ever live up to what she had felt for Ricky, and following her divorce from Myers, she never walked down that aisle again. The issue with Burkhart had apparently had little to do with his personality and more to do with his behavior, as he was described as a workaholic, and Dory found herself in a relationship where she was alone more often than she wasn't. Donna Jean describes Stephen as a good guy when he was sober, but an angry drunk who wasn't interested in quitting. Regardless of how the relationships ended, most of the time, Dory would stay friends with her exes, hanging out and chatting on the phone. It was almost like once someone entered Dory's universe, they would always be a part of it. Despite the two marriages and dating on and off over the years, Dory never really had a strong male presence in the home, and raised her son predominantly on her own. In January of 2006, Dory was 43 years old and living in a home she had purchased in Fort Pierce, a city along Florida's east coast and the seat of St. Lucie County. At the time, she was living alone as her son was in Milwaukee attending college. The three-bedroom, single-family home was located in the 8400 block of Salerno Road. Dory was heavily involved with the upkeep and decoration of her home, with neighbors noting that they always saw her painting, fixing things, and bringing in new furniture. The house meant a lot to her. It was something she'd gotten through her own hard work and perseverance, and she was focused on ensuring it always looked its best. Ultimately, Dory had gone to cosmetology school and obtained a license which she would use predominantly as a hairstylist. After moving between different employers over the years, she had gotten herself a seat at a popular salon, Scandals, located in nearby Vero Beach. She quickly developed a long list of clients who loved her approach and her personality. Dory didn't really treat all of her clients like customers, though, often developing friendships with them and hanging out together. As always, Dory maintained her undeniable charm and magnetism, which just seemed to lead people to want to spend time with her. Throughout much of her life, Dory had been a lover of motorcycles and had owned several. Many of her friends also owned them, and they would ride together and hang out at the same bars and lounges. In addition to her love for motorcycles, Dory was also a big-time card player with her preference set to poker. She was very skilled, often participating in tournaments and frequently winning. Outside of this, Donna Jean stated that she and Dory were extremely close, referring to her as her best friend. She explained that she and Dory spent a lot of time together shopping and visiting yard sales. The sisters had a dual love for puzzles and often would work on them together. And even when they were separated by distance, the two kept in touch with frequent phone calls where they'd watch certain television shows together. At the time, it seemed everything was moving along pretty well. Dory was working, hanging out with friends, playing in tournaments, and working on her house. She was happy for the most part, although there was still an open space in her heart which she hadn't managed to fill. It wasn't something that she thought about too often, but friends would note there was almost a sliver of sadness when Dory spoke about the future, as if the plan she'd made so many years earlier with Ricky still haunted her in that they would never be fulfilled. Unfortunately, whatever future Dory might have been hoping to find, she would mysteriously vanish just a few days into the new year of 2006. The morning of Tuesday, January 10th, began as usual for Dory. That afternoon, she had made plans with her sister to make the 45-minute trip north to Melbourne to take her stepmother to lunch. According to Donna Jean, she called Dory that morning to inform her that she wouldn't be able to make the trip, and while Dory was disappointed by the news, she understood. We don't know with any certainty where Dory went or how she spent the majority of her day, but the timeline becomes somewhat tighter as we approach the evening hours. That night, there was a Texas Hold'em tournament scheduled to take place at one of Dory's favorite hole-in-the-wall spots. The Hillbilly Hideaway has been described as a bar frequented mostly by locals as it's tucked back off the street and hard to find if you don't know it's there. Dory had become familiar with the bar through her job as the salon where she worked was less than a 5-minute drive away. She was excited about playing in the tournament since a week earlier she'd won. This week, she was looking to step up to the $5,000 table, but arriving late, she found all of the seats were already filled. Reportedly, Dory decided to hang around and wait for a space to open up. She took a seat at the bar, ordering only water, where she chatted with friends and played video poker for approximately 30 minutes. Finally, tired of waiting, Dory stood up from her bar stool and walked out just before 8 p.m. According to Donna Jean, when speaking on the Unfound podcast, she stated that her sister may have made a quick stop off after leaving the Hideaway, traveling 7 miles south along US 1 to Pineapple Joe's Bar and Grill. Dory knew this spot well, and according to her sister, it was one of her favorite places to hang around. We don't know very much about Dory's time there. However, Donna Jean noted that employees later told her that, much like at the Hillbilly Hideaway, Dory had been there and was drinking only water. Dory's final stop that night would take her another 6 miles south to the St. Lucie Inn, located just 10 miles southeast of her Salerno Road home at 2102 North Old Dixie Highway. While not much information is known about why Dory may have gone to the inn that night, her sister thinks it's somewhat out of the usual for her. We do know, however, that she was seen there. No one seems to know for certain what time Dory left that night and whether or not she was alone. Either way, her vehicle was spotted approaching her home not a long time later, and it's believed that Dory arrived home between 9 and 10 p.m. Whatever happened over the course of the next 5 hours has been at the core of this disturbing mystery for 17 long and painful years. At approximately 3 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, January 11th, Cindy Gammes, a neighbor of Dory's, was awakened by a series of loud sounds. Along with her husband, Cindy climbed out of bed and looked out the window towards the house across the street. The two watched as Dory's car, a black 1998 Toyota Corolla, slowly rolled out of the driveway and turned, heading out of the neighborhood. As the vehicle disappeared from sight, their gaze was drawn back to Dory's home, where they could see a dim orange glow emanating from the backside of the house. Moments later, the light intensified and it became quite obvious that the house was on fire. Grabbing the phone, Cindy dialed 911, and within minutes, both the police and fire department were en route. The nearest fire station was located just over 2.5 miles from the home, so firefighters arrived on the scene pretty quickly. While the fire had appeared to be growing slowly, by the time the hoses were being used, flames were pouring out of the windows and jutting through the roof. It wasn't a difficult fire to manage, but it was apparent to almost everyone on the scene that night that this appeared to be more than an accidental fire. As firefighters continued working to neutralize the blaze, members of the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office arrived on the scene and were quickly approached by neighbors, who informed them that they had seen Dory's car leaving the house just moments before the fire broke out. Whether or not officers attempted to track down the car or follow in the direction it had been traveling is unknown. Cindy would later tell authorities that they had heard several sounds that night leading up to the fire. Sometime between midnight and 2 a.m., Cindy stated that her husband heard loud voices arguing in the direction of Dory's home. In response, the couple clicked on their front porch light, which seemed to cause the arguing voices to stop. Later, in the early morning hours, at approximately 3 a.m., the couple was awakened by sounds coming in through a bedroom window. Both reported that they had heard the sound of Dory's garage door opening, followed by car doors slamming, and what Cindy described as a loud pop and may have been the trunk closing. Moments later, the car left the driveway. Neither Cindy nor her husband could get a clear look at anyone in the car and could not state for certain how many people were present or if Dory was there. Now, at the time of their arrival, investigators weren't exactly sure what they were dealing with. While the fire didn't appear to have been accidental, they initially theorized that it may have been set purposefully by Dory in order to cash in on an insurance claim. This possibility was very quickly dismissed by everyone who knew the 43-year-old, as they told police that not only did Dory love that house, she wasn't in a situation where she was barely scraping by or in desperate need of some fast cash. Despite this, investigators weren't quite ready to change their approach, at least not without some more information. Their primary goal in those first few hours was to try and locate Dory so they could find out what exactly had happened. By approximately 5 a.m., the fire at the home was mostly out, and firefighters were going through making sure there weren't any other small fires still burning. The fire had been mostly contained to the back third of the house, with firefighters noting that approximately 30% of the home had been destroyed. Other rooms, which had been partially destroyed from both water and smoke, were estimated to have sustained $50,000 worth of damage. Chief Buddy Emerson would later determine the cause of the fire was arson, noting that the blaze had started in several different places and there was clear evidence that an accelerant had been used. Emerson also stated that a flammable liquid was found at the scene, though it was never specified what exactly it was. Sadly, while sweeping through the scorched home, firefighters pushed open the door to the computer room where they found the bodies of Dory's beloved pets. Emily, a 10-year-old black lab that was chubby enough for Dory to playfully refer to her as Flabalab, and her 6-year-old cat, Miss Pris. It appeared that prior to the fire being set, someone had corralled the animals into the room, something friends and family say Dory herself would have never done. She loved her pets, and she wasn't the type to lock them off into a small room, and she certainly wouldn't have left them to die if she'd known about or had any ability to stop the fire. Around the same time investigators were first getting access to the burned home, a sheriff's department in another county was responding to a call for their own fire. Not long before 6 a.m., the Glades County Sheriff's Office was contacted by an individual who reported a car fire at a rural boat launch near Lake Okeechobee. The car was spotted in Lakeport near the town of Moorhaven, approximately 80 miles southwest of Dory's house. Responding within minutes, the fire department arrived at the scene quickly, but found the vehicle completely engulfed in flames. While they were able to put the blaze down pretty quick, the vehicle itself was almost completely destroyed. When sheriff's deputies ran the vehicle's information through their system, they quickly determined that it belonged to Dory Myers. For investigators, they now had two pressing questions. Who set that car on fire, and where exactly was Dory Myers? Back at the burned home on Salerno Road, sheriff's investigators were notified about the discovery of the car, and quickly their perspectives began to shift from insurance scam to abduction, saying they believed the fire had been set to destroy identifying evidence. While going through the home, they would find additional evidence to support their theory. First, they found Dory's cell phone, left behind in the house, and according to friends and family, she would never have left her phone. Second, and perhaps most pertinently, they located Dory's purse. Nothing seemed to be missing from the bag, and all of Dory's credit cards, cash, and identification had been left untouched. While investigators have never specified whether it was Dory's cell phone or her landline, they did find a series of numbers from people who had recently called. They decided to start calling the numbers, wondering if perhaps someone might have some information or may have spoken to Dory in the hours leading up to the fire. The first number they called belonged to Joe Jones, Dory's former live-in boyfriend. While the couple had split up some months earlier, they remained in touch, as was Dory's normal routine. Jones told investigators that he worked as a trucker, and he had called and chatted with Dory several times a day. Reportedly, Jones told police that he was in Missouri that night and had called Dory between 9:30 and 10 p.m. Jones told police that he had been frustrated by the conversation, stating that Dory had told him she'd met two United States Marines who were back home after having been wounded in Iraq. Since the men apparently had no place to stay, Dory allegedly told Jones that she had invited the two men to come home with her, offering them a place to stay for the night. Jones later explained the conversation to the Orlando Sentinel, saying, quote, "She said one was going to sleep on the sofa in the living room and the other on a pullout sofa in the back. It kind of aggravated me that she had brought a couple of guys home, but Dory always had compassion for young people in the military. She felt they were fighting and dying, and she wanted to help these guys out." End quote. Some of this information was confirmed at the scene itself, with investigators finding blankets and pillows set up on the couch in the living room as though someone were preparing to sleep there, as well as a pull-out bed which had been made up in the back game room. Now, investigators found themselves in a difficult position. If Jones' story was true, and Dory did invite these two men back to her home, any number of things could have happened. They could have truly been military veterans, but perhaps saw Dory as an easy target. There was also, of course, the possibility that they had lied to her about their service as a way to disarm her. According to friends and family, Dory had a special place in her heart for veterans, and this affinity and desire to help may have led to her inviting these two monsters into her home. Investigators were desperate to track down Dory, and now they were also looking for two so-called Marines about whom they knew almost nothing. They didn't even have physical descriptions. Seeking assistance from the public, St. Lucie County Sheriff Ken Mascara spoke to the media, explaining in part, quote, "We're extremely concerned about Miss Meyer's well-being, and we are using every means possible to uncover any clues to find Miss Meyer's. We are calling on the assistance of anyone who may have come into contact with Miss Meyer's or had seen her vehicle between St. Lucie County and Glades County." End quote. Strangely, it wasn't the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office that informed Dory's family about the two fires and her subsequent disappearance. Instead, according to Donna Jean, after speaking with the police, Joe Jones notified her father, who in turn contacted her. Receiving the news that Dory was missing devastated the family, who immediately knew something terrible had to have happened. If Dory wanted to leave or run off somewhere, surely she would have done so without destroying her beloved home and killing her pets. In hopes of determining the identities of the two men who may have been with Dory that night, investigators began tracking her movements on the night of the 10th. First, arriving at the Hillbilly Hideaway, they received confirmation that Dory had been there. However, no one had seen her spending time with or leaving with anyone else. Reportedly, Dory was also spotted at Pineapple Joe's. However, again, she wasn't seen with anyone and appeared to be traveling alone. Next, she went to the St. Lucie Inn, where investigators learned about the two alleged Marines. According to a witness at the bar that night, they saw Dory speaking with two women who were accompanied by two unidentified men. Sometime later, the witness reported that the two women were no longer around, but Dory was sitting with the two unknown men. Dory was again drinking water, and the witness believed she spoke with the men for approximately 30 minutes. Nothing suspicious appeared to be going on, and nothing seemed wrong, so no one paid all that much attention. I should also note, another report stated that the two men had come in with one woman and another man, who also both left before Dory started speaking with them. No one saw Dory nor the two men leave that night, so whether or not they went with her, no one can say for certain. The witness, though, did get enough of a look at the men to give a basic description to investigators. One was described as a white male who was wearing a white baseball cap. The other was described as having a darker complexion and was believed to have possibly been of Hispanic or Native American ancestry. Lieutenant Jerry Rothman of the sheriff's office released these descriptions to the media, labeling the men as subjects of interest and requesting that anyone who may have seen them or Dory to contact investigators immediately. After leaving the St. Lucie Inn, investigators mapped out several different routes that Dory may have taken on the 10-mile drive home. They then drove the different routes, stopping at each gas station and convenience store along the way, showing Dory's picture and giving descriptions of the unknown men in hopes that someone might have seen them. Unfortunately, either the trio didn't stop along the way that night, or they stopped somewhere a little more out of the way. Having put together the last few hours of the night, investigators next focused in on interviews. They wanted to speak with friends, family members, clients, coworkers, and ex-boyfriends, hoping that someone may know the two men she was with that night or might be able to offer some insight into what might have happened. Working off of the very vague descriptions given by the witness at the bar, investigators released composite drawings. These images were printed in local papers alongside photos of Dory and the circumstances of her disappearance. In addition, the images were shown to everyone who knew Dory, but not one person recognized them. Dory's sister, Donna Jean, had been working hard to produce missing persons flyers for distribution and quickly snatched up the composites, adding them to the flyers she was constructing through the use of a copy machine. The family began offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to Dory's safe return, and Donna Jean was out putting the flyers everywhere she possibly could. She later explained to the St. Lucie News Tribune, saying, quote, "We've got to get these people. We've got to find her. She's my baby sister, my only sister, and I just want to bring her home. I want people to look at my sister's face and look at those two men," end quote. Within the first weeks of the investigation into Dory's disappearance, dozens of tips were called into the sheriff's office. Mark Weinberg, a spokesman for the sheriff's, noted that while investigators were working with the information as it was called in, they hadn't yet received a tip that could really break the case open. In hopes of spreading the word as quickly as possible, Sheriff Mascara appeared on several nationally televised shows and discussed the case and its developments, few as they were at the time. Around this same time, Treasure Coast Crime Stoppers began offering a $1,000 reward for Dory's safe return, increasing the total available amount to $6,000. The more time passed without answers, the more difficult it became for Dory's family to sit by waiting. While they worked to maintain their hope that Dory would be returned safely, they couldn't keep the darker possibilities at bay forever. Dale Curry, Dory's father, spoke with the Sentinel about the case and the two men who had been seen with his daughter. He stated, quote, "I think Dory just fell for it when they said they had just returned from Iraq and had no place to stay. She befriended them, and then they turn around and do this. We're afraid she's dead, but why on earth would somebody do that unless they are born killers?" End quote. Within weeks of Dory's disappearance, the investigation was already hitting dead ends. While they were receiving tips, primarily called into the sheriff's office, tracking them down never helped progress the case. January would come to an end with no new information or leads, and February would go the same way. In March, just 2 days before what would mark the 2-month anniversary of Dory's disappearance, her sister wrote an article which appeared in the St. Lucie News Tribune. It read, in part, quote, "We still have no information on the whereabouts of Dory. Every day that goes by gets more and more frustrating. These criminals are evil and dangerous, and they need to be apprehended. I have to hold on to the hope that Dory is still alive and being held against her will, but I am not so naive that I also know that something more sinister could have happened. We have tried desperately to get Dory's story out there nationwide. We are desperate to find Dory." End quote. Donna Jean and Dale were very focused on keeping Dory's name in the public, knowing that the faster the story faded, the faster people would begin to forget. They knew that it was extremely important to keep both the case and Dory's face fresh in the minds of Floridians who may have information they didn't even realize was vital. Dale explained, quote, "If her story dies, we're going to lose all these contacts, all these leads," end quote. Dale stated that it was not uncommon for him to be on his computer late into the early morning hours, shooting off emails to television producers in an attempt to get his daughter's story covered, even if for just a few minutes. Donna Jean said that in order to keep the story from fading, she had enlisted assistance from friends who were helping to spread the flyers all across the country. She also had patches of the flyer made up, which she ironed on to some of her clothing, as well as putting a large decal of her sister on the back of her truck. In late March, the Palm Beach Post put out a detailed article addressing the case and the investigation itself, noting that 73 days had passed since Dory had last been seen, and 72 days had passed since investigators had released any information. By this point, many were beginning to wonder if perhaps the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office was in over its head. As difficult as it was for everyone involved, it never got any easier for Donna Jean. She buried herself trying to do everything she could to assist, but she was also struggling with issues in her own life, namely her husband, who was at the time on a waiting list for a liver transplant. Times were not easy under normal circumstances, but with Dory gone, it seemed everything got a little worse. Donna Jean acknowledged that sometimes she called her sister's cell phone, not expecting an answer, but just wanting to hear her voice on the outgoing message. "I'm still living at January 11th, she noted. Discussing the details of the case, both Donna Jean and Dale noted their struggle to accept some of how they were told it may have happened. While both acknowledged that Dory had a soft spot for veterans and often went out of her way to help, neither believed she would have brought two complete strangers home for the night. She might have given money, offered a ride, or even paid for a hotel room, but she would never have taken two people back to her place not knowing who they were or what they were capable of. For Donna Jean, the only way those guys got through was if Dory knew them or she knew someone who vouched for them. Joe Jones, for his part, disagreed, saying, quote, "I know if they conned her saying they were Marines, she fell for that," end quote. One interesting new detail was revealed during an interview with Donna Jean, however. She claimed that her father was told by investigators that they had received a tip that Dory had been seen in a vehicle with two men on a Seminole tribe reservation just a few miles from Lake Okeechobee, slightly north from where the car was recovered. A man on the reservation was reportedly questioned about Dory, though who this man is and how official the questioning was, no one seems to know. However, a witness from the St. Lucie Inn told reporters that she had been shown a photo lineup which included a picture of the man from the reservation. Asked about this, Chief Deputy Gary Wilson stated that they had been doing a lot of photo lineups with witnesses as well as people who had known Dory. Wilson wanted to make it clear that they were still working the case even if they weren't getting the results they hoped for, explaining, quote, "So far, we have not developed any solid suspects from those efforts. This has not taken on a cold case type of existence at the sheriff's office," end quote. Donna Jean went on to explain that the family was trying to organize a search through the swampy area near where Dory's car had been found. However, sheriff's investigators had urged them not to do so, noting that there was a good chance they could damage evidence during the search since they didn't have the proper training or knowledge of how to handle it. Without anything else to do, Donna Jean kept making flyers and spreading them around the country. Still, she found herself disheartened, as she'd often find places taking the flyers down a month or two later. Frustrated, Donna Jean wondered aloud, quote, "I guess it's not a happy thing to look at," end quote. 3 months later, with the case remaining in a stagnant state, the family decided to organize an event in hopes of raising awareness of Dory's plight. Friends and family members gathered at a flea market along US 1 in Vero Beach on Friday, June 16th. There, they held up photos of Dory, enlarged versions of her missing persons flyer, and the composites of the two unknown men. Asked why they were there, Dale replied, quote, "We're not passing up any opportunities to keep Dory's name circulating out there. Hopefully, this will stir up some leads," end quote. They waved to passing cars, handed out flyers to people who walked by, and hoped to gather up enough attention to get local newspapers to write about the event and therefore keep Dory in the headlines. Many believe that someone in the area had more information than they were sharing, and Donna Jean hoped that the more people had to see Dory, the harder it would be to ignore the voice of their conscience. Donna Jean noted, quote, "I've made up signs and posters. I've gone on the computer. Hopefully, someone will come forward and say, I know something about this." End quote. Asked about the case, Deputy Mike Sumner gave a boilerplate statement, saying, quote, "We're following leads that came in through the tip line. Sometimes it's just a matter of the clock ticking its time. I know the family members are under duress because Dory hasn't been found." End quote. The event was a success, at least in terms of getting the word out. In regard to local papers and television news stations, it worked, and a few articles rolled out. But as quickly as the interest of the media was caught, it was lost. The lack of developments and inability on the part of investigators to share any new information resulted in articles regurgitating the same information over and over, to a point where many papers felt that there was nothing new to print, and until there was, there was no reason to keep retelling the same story. 2006 would come to an end with no new leads, developments, or solid information. For the most part, the known facts of Dory's case remained unchanged throughout the year. While investigators had released what they knew the day after the fire, they had never included any new information since then. By January 10th, 2007, the one-year anniversary of Dory's disappearance, it didn't look like that was going to be changing. Detective Ron Wentz of the Sheriff's Office told the St. Lucie News Tribune that investigators had several things developing. He noted they were pursuing leads and working with other law enforcement agencies, though he would not give any details beyond that. A year after the disappearance of her sister, Donna Jean was finding it hard to keep the faith. She thought of Dory every day, created and distributed flyers, designed a website, and spent much of her free time reaching out to the media in an effort to keep the story alive. Unfortunately, it was an overwhelming task, and without something new, no one appeared to be interested in Dory's tale. Donna Jean explained, quote, "Every day I think about her. I really don't know any more today than I did a year ago. It seems that every time you take 2 steps forward, you take 10 steps back. I guess there are just too many missing people for them to choose from, but I'm not going to give up. Somebody knows something. I know that something horrible happened, but I still have to have a corner of my heart that says one day she's going to walk through the door." End quote. In late January, Dory's family made the difficult and emotional choice to have her legally declared dead. Her home, which had been sitting still burned and wrecked from the fire, needed to be repaired. While insured, Dory was the policyholder, and so those funds could not be accessed to pay for the work, and neighbors had been calling in to report the home as an eyesore. Dale explained, quote, "To us, it's a legal issue, not a moral issue. Legally, it had to be done. Morally, I'm not giving up hope that someday, somehow, Dory will come home. I wouldn't be much of a father if I didn't think that." End quote. Dory's son, Jesse King, was the sole beneficiary of her estate, and following the declaration, he could now get the house fixed. The order, which was signed by Circuit Judge Ben L. Bryan Jr., came through following testimony from family members as well as investigators from the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office, who stated their belief that Dory had been the victim of an abduction and likely homicide. For Donna Jean, while she understood the legal necessity, she just couldn't bring herself to participate. It broke her heart, and it felt somehow like acknowledging defeat, but she was nowhere near giving up. Over the course of the next year, not much would change. Investigators reported that they received approximately 1 tip a week via telephone and normally were able to track down the lead within a day or two, none of them ever leading to anything of significance. In January of 2008, it was revealed that a private investigation firm, National Investigative and Forensic Examiners, had previously volunteered their time and efforts to take on the case. Jim Hanna, with the firm, told reporters that he believed the case was solvable and he thought his firm could be the one to break it open. During the course of their investigation, agents with the firm had traveled all around the state of Florida, conducting interviews and gathering information. All that they were able to obtain was turned over to the sheriff's office, with Detective Ron Wentz describing them as having a good working relationship. Asked why the case didn't seem to draw in as much attention as it once did, Detective Wentz replied, quote, "It's very tough to keep the public interested because it's in their face for 1 or 2 months and then it's gone," end quote. Donna Jean expressed her pain and frustration, describing her daily fight to keep Dory's name alive. She stated, quote, "I'm trying to keep Dory's story out there. I figured that if I keep her picture and name out there, at some point somebody's going to say, oh my God, I saw her. I want to keep Dory fresh in people's minds. Every day she's fresh in my mind. She's not a distant memory to me. It's very hard to talk about. There's no closure. It's kind of hard to grieve her loss when I don't know for a fact that she's gone," end quote. What information the firm managed to obtain, we don't know. The continuing silence from law enforcement began moving minds in different directions. While some believed they were onto something and were keeping it quiet so as not to blow the lead, others figured they were completely lost and were in no position to make any advancements in the case. That kind of opinion can easily breed disdain, and there are certainly several people out there who are of the opinion that investigators either were not skilled enough to solve the case, or perhaps did not care enough to put in the effort necessary. For their part, law enforcement officers were adamant that they were doing everything they possibly could. Detective Wentz described the case as bouncing from one extreme to the other, saying the case, quote, "runs hot and cold. Months can go by and I won't hear anything. Then there'll be a flurry of activity. I've been all over the place with this investigation. I'm still working on active leads. In fact, I got new information as late as last week that I'm working on. It's too early to tell if it's a viable lead or not. I've had several leads that looked promising that didn't pan out," end quote. Wentz would offer few details about this new lead, saying that it involved witnesses who had seen Dory with the two unidentified men, but no additional details were supplied. Unfortunately, this is kind of where the investigation into Dory's disappearance seems to hit a dead end. Time continues moving forward, and while no one forgot about Dory, life has a way of pushing you. Days turn to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. Tragically, on Wednesday, April 22nd, 2015, Dale Curry passed away at the age of 78. For the last 9 years of his life, he tried to live to the best of his abilities while also hoping each day for news of his missing daughter. An Army veteran who had served in Korea, Dale was a well-respected member of the community and beloved by his family. He had hoped to find the truth of Dory's disappearance before his time in this world came to an end, but unfortunately, the calendar came to its conclusion too soon. Donna Jean, devastated by the loss of her father, now took on the full responsibility of being Dory's primary advocate. 1 year later, January 10th of 2016, marked one full decade since Dory had last been seen. For Donna Jean, it was a grim anniversary, but one she hoped would bring renewed energy to the case and possibly a slew of new articles to refresh the minds of the community. In the meantime, she had been doing her own work to keep the story going. She created a website, a Facebook page, and began distributing Justice for Dory bracelets at the annual Community United Effort Center for Missing Persons Conference. Shortly after Dory's disappearance, Donna Jean had gotten in touch with a nonprofit organization and eventually became a Florida outreach coordinator. In hopes of helping others through the pain and grief she had experienced, Donna Jean created missing persons flyers, conference posters, and booklets for the families with missing loved ones. Her Facebook page became, in essence, a tribute to her work, as she was often uploading new missing persons flyers, hoping to spread the word about the cases and keep their names alive, just as she had been doing for her own sister all those years. She explained, quote, "It's healing to talk to other families that are new to this. You can give them comfort because you've already been there. People want you to forget about it. Until I find out what happened to her, I can't let it go," end quote. In terms of the investigation, by this point, Detective Ron Wentz was the lead investigator and also the only member of law enforcement who had been on the case since day one. Detective Wentz stated that in the first few months of the investigation, they had searched in four separate Florida counties for Dory and evidence connected to her disappearance. Wentz stated that the case was still alive, with their focus in both St. Lucie and Glades counties. However, they hadn't received any solid tips or promising leads in a long time. Detective Wentz put it fairly bluntly, saying, quote, "We are looking for any evidence related to her disappearance, logically, including her body," end quote. Donna Jean admitted that she found some comfort in knowing that Wentz was still working the case. She explained, quote, "I appreciate that he will not give up on the case. That gives me hope. So much time has gone by, and the circumstances are horrible. I just want to know what happened. They're still out there. That's a scary thought," end quote. In May of 2019, Donna Jean sat down to do an interview on Ed Dentzel's podcast, Unfound. This was a long and comprehensive interview, which I highly recommend you listen to. While Donna Jean had a lot to say, I'm only going to focus in on a few details which stood out to me as particularly curious. Firstly, Donna Jean stated that when the family was going through the house after the fire, they found several things which really grabbed their attention. They noted broken beer bottles spread throughout the kitchen, and while they knew the efforts of firefighters would have overturned much of the house, the bottles were different. Apparently, Dory was the type to keep things neat in her home, and if she had people over drinking, bottles were thrown in the trash before new ones were taken. Yet here it seemed like empty bottles had been left scattered throughout the kitchen, which was very unlike Dory. In addition, the family found an ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts. Again, Dory was very neat and would empty ashtrays frequently. She hated the sight of cigarettes falling every which way and making a mess. Another note here is that the family specifically stated that some of the cigarettes in the ashtrays were not Dory's brand. Beyond that, an empty beer bottle was found in the freezer of a brand that Dory didn't drink. Gathering up the bottles and the cigarettes, Dory's son Jesse turned these items over to investigators. Whether or not they were ever tested for DNA or analyzed in any other way has never been addressed. Donna Jean went on to note that her sister had taken a trip out of the country a month or so prior to her disappearance. Dory had apparently traveled to Belize with a friend, Jimmy Lee, and was excited upon her return. She'd taken a lot of photos during the trip, but hadn't yet gotten around to putting them in an album. The reason this stood out for Donna Jean was because they found those photos spread out on a counter in Dory's guest bathroom. While there's no way of knowing if this was of any significance, Donna Jean couldn't help but find that extremely odd, wondering, who looks at pictures in the bathroom? Donna Jean would go on to explain that certain areas of the home appeared to have sustained more fire damage than others. While the couch in the living room was left in good shape, the television across the room was partially melted. A wall-mounted CD player had bent from the heat and slid down the wall, lying in a twisted heap on the floor. A bottle of vodka was located next to the television, which the family found odd. Dory would make mixed drinks, but she never walked around drinking straight from the bottle, and she wouldn't have stood for other people doing that in her house had she the ability to do anything about it. Was it possible that the vodka was one of the accelerants? Maybe. Dory's bedroom had also been involved in the fire, although again, it looked like the blaze was mainly focused in on a particular area. According to Donna Jean, her bed had been burned out, but one side had burned much more than the other, and it looked as though the blankets were missing. Donna Jean noted that the side of the bed which had been burned the worst was the side Dory usually slept on. Throughout the rest of the house, all of the windows had been closed. Not only had someone shut them, but they had done so with such haste that in many instances the curtains were partially hanging outside of the house. A baseball bat, which Dory kept next to her bed for security, was also missing. In addition, Donna Jean stated that a rifle, which belonged to Dory's son, was found broken in two pieces, with one being left near the front door and the other next to the couch. Donna Jean noted that there was no ammunition for the rifle in the house, leading her to believe that if Dory had taken that gun out in defense, she had to have been in a desperate situation. Unfortunately, this would be the last major interview in which Donna Jean would participate. 5 months later, on Saturday, October 26th, she passed away while surrounded by loved ones. She was just 59 years old. Donna Jean had never lived an easy life, but she'd lived one full of love. Sadly, the last 10 years of that life were overwhelmed by the disappearance of her sister and subsequent family tragedies, but she had never allowed that to deter her. She chose a path, marched forward, and did everything she could to find the truth of what became of her sister and those who were responsible. Her light may have been extinguished before her work was through, but the echoes of her efforts will ring for years to come. When last seen, Dory Ann Curry Myers is described as being a white female with brown hair and eyes, standing between 5'2" and 5'3" and weighing between 110 and 115 pounds. Dory has the following tattoos: a wizard and a Harley Davidson emblem on her back, a rose on her left earlobe, unspecified tattoos on her abdomen, each buttock, and one extending down her left thigh. She has a 4-inch scar on her right shoulder and pins inserted into the ankle. She may wear eyeglasses or contacts. Dory is believed to have been wearing 3 gold necklaces when she disappeared. One with a hairdresser's scissor charm, one with a charm reading Lil Sis, and one with a Harley Davidson motorcycle charm. Dory was last seen at the St. Lucie Inn, 2102 North Dixie Highway, on the evening of Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. She may have been in the company of 2 unidentified men who claimed to be Marines wounded in battle. One, a white male wearing a white baseball cap. The other, a male of either Hispanic or possibly Native American origin. Her car, a 1998 Toyota Corolla, was found burning at a rural boat launch between Lakeport and Moorhaven, 80 miles southwest of Dory's home near the west coast of Lake Okeechobee. Dory was 43 years old when last seen, and if alive today, she would be turning 61 this year. 17 years have passed since Dory Myers left the St. Lucie Inn and mysteriously vanished as her house was set ablaze. For nearly the entire time, information has been limited and developments few, if at all. Almost all of Dory's immediate family have since passed, with her son Jesse still alive and hoping to one day learn the truth of what happened and to see those responsible face justice. Donna Jean dedicated the last years of her life to trying to find her beloved sister. When she created a website to try and spread word of the case, she included a poem she had written about Dory, her love for her sister, and her desperate need to find her. It reads, "You were my little tag along, but I didn't mind. There was a big world out there we had to find. Our lives were hard, but we played the hands we were dealt, wondering if anyone knew just how we felt. Years of sacrifice just trying to belong. Then before I knew it, you were gone. No more the responsibility of watching over you. The real world has come into view. How I yearn for your sometimes annoying ways and to bring back our happiest days. You looked up to me. I never understood why. Your faith in me makes me cry. My heart is breaking, always aching for my little tag along. Your disappearance is just so wrong. I wait impatiently for news of your whereabouts, always nervous and so full of doubts. I pray, I cry, I scream. I wish this all was a dream. I'm so full of anger and rage, my feelings are so hard to gauge. With God's good graces and wills that be, I hope to have you home again. So many things we have yet to see. Please come tag along with me, to my sister, my best friend. I love you, Sisma." My life can get a little hectic sometimes, whether it's keeping up at work, helping out with the family, or just trying to get things done around the house. it can really wear you down. Thankfully, Daily Harvest does more so I can do less. Think stress-free meals delivered to your doorstep, aka they have my back. Daily Harvest delivers delicious harvest bowls, soups, flatbreads, snacks, smoothies, lattes, and more, built on organic fruits and vegetables. Daily Harvest works directly with farmers to source the best ingredients, freezes them at peak ripeness to lock in flavor and nutrients, and they never use artificial preservatives or ingredients. With nourishing and easy-to-prep options, I never have to think twice about what to eat for my next meal, snack, or dessert. I'm a big smoothie guy. It can be a challenge for me to eat solid food in the morning, and Daily Harvest delivers some of the best I've ever had. The mango and papaya is almost too good to be true, while the strawberry and cashew has become an all-time favorite. When it comes to sitting down for a real dinner, I can't more highly recommend the squash and wild rice gratin. Now, I don't have to run around the kitchen looking for the quick, delicious fix when I've got Daily Harvest ready to go. Let Daily Harvest do more so you can do less. Go to dailyharvest.com/trace to get $40 off your first box. That's dailyharvest.com/trace for up to $40 off your first box. dailyharvest.com/trace. If you're like me, even when you're doing your best to concentrate on reports for work, organization of your home, or even a new hobby, you're not always 100% focused, and you're not always getting everything done as quickly and efficiently as you need to. Well, I've found the perfect solution in Magic Mind. I found this little shot that improved my morning so much. I love that I can take it with me anywhere and drink it whenever I need a quick energy burst. Instead of drinking that much coffee to have energy, I now drink Magic Mind every morning, and I've cut down from 4 cups to none. Magic Mind makes me more productive and focused. I get more done in less time thanks to the nootropics inside that improve attention, concentration, and cognition. I feel way better in the mornings, and I'm happier throughout the day thanks to the adaptogens that boost your mood and help you relax. Magic Mind is full of wonderful ingredients like ashwagandha, an adaptogen that reduces stress and anxiety, which really helps bring a level of calm and focus that's normally difficult for me to attain. If you're like me, then I can't more highly recommend Magic Mind. I love sharing Magic Mind with friends. We're all coffee addicts, and this has helped us cut back. I've been sharing Magic Mind with my family as well. My cousin has been struggling with her memory, and this little drink has some amazing ingredients that support memory and cognition. Now, with this special offer, you too can try this amazing little drink, Magic Mind. The Magic Mind team created a super offer for me to share with you. You can get up to 56% off your first subscription in the next 10 days and 20% off your one-time purchase by using the code TRACEEVIDENCE. You can also go to magicmind.co/traceevidence and redeem the discount code TRACEEVIDENCE, all one word. But hurry up. The 56% discount only lasts 10 days from the airing of this episode. So visit magicmind.co/traceevidence to get started today. Your dog gives their best every day, and they deserve the same from you. Feed them real good food with Nom Nom. Nom Nom delivers fresh dog food with every portion personalized to your dog's needs so you can bring out their best. Nom Nom's made with real whole food you can see and recognize without any additives or fillers that contribute to bloating and low energy. That's because Nom Nom uses the latest science and insights to make real good food for dogs. Their nutrient-packed recipes are crafted by board-certified veterinary nutritionists, made fresh and shipped free to your door. Nom Nom's already delivered over 40 million meals to good dogs like yours, inspiring millions of clean bowls and tail wags. I love my crazy little dogs and feel great giving them better nutrition. Rosie and Maggie really love the beef mash. Loaded with beef, potatoes, eggs, carrots, and peas, not only have I noticed they're a lot happier come dinner time, they're so full of energy and their coats have started looking nicer. Seeing them fulfilled makes me feel like a good dog parent. Plus, Nom Nom comes with a money-back guarantee. If your dog's tail isn't wagging within 30 days, Nom Nom will refund your first order. No fillers, no nonsense, just Nom Nom. Go right now for 50% off your no-risk two-week trial at trynom.com/trace. That's trynom.com/trace for 50% off. trynom.com/trace. On a quiet Tuesday night, 43-year-old Dorianne Myers went out to join a poker tournament. When she arrived late, she couldn't get a seat at a table and decided to head off to a new location. Not long after, a witness saw her speaking to two unidentified men at the St. Lucie Inn, approximately 10 miles from her home in the 8400 block of Salerno Road, Fort Pierce. From there, almost everything we know comes from one primary source, who spoke to Dory on the phone sometime between 9:30 and 10 p.m. Reportedly, Dory had encountered two men who stated that they were United States Marines who had been injured in Iraq previously. Dory, known for having a soft spot for members of the military, spent approximately 30 minutes with the men before leaving the inn. According to her ex-boyfriend, Joe Jones, when he called that night, Dory told him the story of two men and said that she'd offered them a place to stay for the night. One would sleep on the living room couch, the other on a pull-out bed in the back game room. Just a few hours later, fire erupted from the back of the home as Dory's black 1998 Toyota Corolla was spotted slowly driving away. Fire department investigators determined the fire had been arson, noting that it had started in several different locations and an accelerant was clearly used. Just 3 hours after the fire was reported, a fire department 80 miles south in Glades County responded to a car fire out near a rural boat launch between Moorhaven and Lakeport, not far from the western bank of Lake Okeechobee. It was Dory's Toyota, and by the time the flames were extinguished, almost all of the car had been completely destroyed, leaving no additional clues for investigators. So, detectives of the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office found themselves in a tight spot. Had Dory been abducted and killed by two random men she invited back to her home, or was it possible that she or someone she knew those men? Thus far, if anyone did know them, they had chosen not to speak up about it. With few options, almost no evidence, and a thin flow of tips, the desperate search for Dory quickly took on the shape of a homicide investigation. That's the basic info of Dory's case, and for the most part, that little summary represents almost every known or confirmed detail of this case. While investigators spoke about the case somewhat openly the day after the fire, 17 years later, they've said almost nothing. There have been statements made that leads are being pursued, the case remains active, and it's still being worked. However, there haven't been any results. And while some believe this is the result of a poorly organized investigation, others have noted that there was never a lot of evidence to work with. From poor descriptions of the two unidentified men, leading to very vague composites, to many people who saw Dory that night but didn't see the men, didn't see her leave, and didn't know anything about what was going on. This is seemingly an instance where a popular local woman went out, was seen multiple times, and then everything turned into a bizarre mystery. Now, before we continue, I do want to make a special note. During my research and the writing of this episode, I reached out to investigators at the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office. Specifically, I requested an interview with someone who had knowledge of the case and might help fill in some of the blanks. As I'm sure you've noticed, this is a case full of holes, and it's truly hard to read the lay of the land when giant patches of your map are missing. As a credit to the sheriff's office, they did get back to me. And while they didn't want to provide me with a live interview where I could ask questions as we go along, they did agree to review my questions and provide answers where they could. I submitted a document consisting of 20 different questions dealing with all different aspects of the case. I asked about certain individuals, persons of interest, the two unidentified men, the collection of evidence after the fire, details about the destruction of the car, and a lot of other things. As of the release of this episode, I haven't gotten those answers. However, should I get those answers and they give me details that I'm looking for, I'll issue an update with the pertinent information, as long as they're not answers like we can't answer that because it's an ongoing investigation. So, while I know the investigators in this case have come under a lot of fire and not necessarily without cause, I did want to make it clear that thus far they've been accommodating and helpful during this production. Usually, in a case like this, what I do now is go over the theories, see what fits, what doesn't, what makes sense, or what doesn't make sense. Since this case has had so little information released over the years, we don't exactly have any official theories to work off of. Instead, we'll focus on the circumstances of the case and the different possibilities. These include the two men seen with Dory that night, Dory's ex-boyfriend Joe Jones, and a possible secret boyfriend from Fort Myers. We'll start with the so-called Marines. We have almost nothing on these guys. From what information investigators have released, they stated that they spoke to a witness at the St. Lucie Inn who saw Dory with the men. While the witness did not appear to know who the men were, this person said Dory spent approximately 30 minutes hanging out with them. While one report says the men came in originally with two women, another report says that they actually came in with a woman and a man who left before Dory got involved. All the witness at the inn was able to give investigators in terms of a description was that one man was white and wore a white baseball cap and the other appeared Hispanic or Native American. That's really not a lot to work with. I wish we had more details like what were they wearing? Physically, how were they built? Were they wearing their dog tags? Did they have any identifying tattoos? It seems very odd that all we got were vague descriptions of their faces and nothing more. You can remember this guy was wearing a white hat, but not what color his shirt was. How tall were these guys? Even if you can't give a number, how about in proportion to Dory herself? Were they fit? Did they look like two guys who may have actually been Marines, or were they in poor shape? They were telling people that they'd been wounded in Iraq. Did either of them have any visible scars or injuries? All of these would be really great answers to have, but sadly, we've got none of them. I know that in the passing of a moment, you may not remember something about someone, but they were there for 30 minutes, so this wasn't just a fleeting glance. So, now we are led to believe that these two guys, who either are former Marines injured in combat, or maybe just former Marines who lied about injuries, or even still, two guys who were never in the military but used the wounded warrior story to pick up women. I mean, honestly, that's not an original tale, and plenty of men have been caught up in scams of stolen valor, but I digress. Everyone who knew Dory, except Joe Jones, finds it hard to believe she would have taken these guys in. She had respect for the military. She wanted to help out when she could. But bringing two grown men home that you don't know in any way doesn't sound like being charitable. It sounds outright dangerous and ill-advised. So, is it possible Dory could have known one or both of the men? Certainly. That isn't to say that she was on a first-name basis with them, but maybe she'd seen them around. Friends told reporters that it wasn't uncommon to see Dory hanging around town, chatting with a homeless veteran. She also seemed to be interested in Vietnam veterans, as several people said she was often chatting with locals who had been in the war. So, surely, there's a possibility that Dory met these guys through a friend, perhaps another veteran, or just in the normal course of her daily life. But let's buy it for a second and agree. Dory meets these guys, they tell her their story, she's moved by it and decides to offer up her place for the night. Apparently, these two Marines had cash in their pockets to go to the bar for drinks, but none in regard to getting a hotel room or someplace to stay. In addition to this, since only Dory's car is seen coming and going that night, are we to also be under the assumption that they didn't have their own mode of transportation? If so, how did they get to the bar? Had people seen them lingering around town in the days before the fire? Did they have to come back to the area to pick up a vehicle? Again, all important questions without any answers. I guess one thing about this situation that I struggle to accept is the timeline. Dory goes out to play a poker tournament, one that means a lot to her, but somehow manages to arrive late enough to miss out on getting a seat. That, in and of itself, seems odd, since this was a tournament where she could have won up to $5,000, and it seems unlikely she'd be cavalier about it, especially since she was hoping to earn enough to get into a bigger tournament in Nevada. After waiting for a while, she goes up and heads off to Pineapple Joe's. Then she moves down to the St. Lucie Inn. Now, according to Donna Jean, Dory knew the inn, but it wasn't exactly a place she preferred over others. To the last day of her life, Donna Jean could never understand what caused her sister to go to the inn that night. Either way, this is where the encounter with the so-called Marines takes place. Again, something that I find odd. If Joe Jones is accurate, and if police verified this through phone records, Dory's back at her house with the two Marines between 9:30 and 10 p.m. Maybe it's just me, but that seems really early. Reportedly, she talked with the two men for around 30 minutes before leaving the bar. Would anyone consider 30 minutes enough time to get to know someone well enough to let them stay over at your place for the night? Dory had compassion, but she wasn't a fool. She had street smarts. She knew the dangers of the world. It's difficult to accept the given circumstances. Why not spend more time at the bar to get to know them better, to see if there's anything to worry about? Why just take off and head home before 10 p.m.? The only reasons I can think of are the men really didn't have much cash, so at least back at her place she had food and drinks, or she knew them or knew someone who did. I mean, let's face it, we can't even rule out the possibility that the entire reason she went to the inn that night was to meet these fellas, perhaps at the urging of someone she knew. After Dory leaves the inn, we don't know much else. They arrive at her house sometime between 9:30 and 10. Dory makes up the beds for them. Cigarettes are smoked and drinks are flowing. Approximately 2 to 4 hours after arriving, between midnight and 2 a.m., neighbors report hearing sounds of an argument, loud voices coming from the direction of Dory's home. Dory, who could sometimes party a little too loudly, had previously spoken to her closest neighbors. She asked them that if she was ever causing a disturbance, to just let her know and she'd calm it down. She didn't want people to pick up the phone calling the police, who would then respond to a noise disturbance. Apparently, when the neighbors heard the noises that night, instead of calling the police, they just flipped on their porch light. The voices stopped, and that was the last of it. Around 3 a.m., neighbors were awakened when they heard sounds they later described as the garage door opening, car door slamming, and possibly a trunk closing. They looked outside and saw the car leaving from across the street as the house slowly caught fire. No one saw the driver. No one saw Dory. No one knows where that car went. When firefighters put the blaze out, they find clear signs of arson. The fire started in multiple places. An accelerant was used. The fire was contained to certain areas. They opened up the computer room door and found Dory's beloved dog and cat dead. A cruel act perpetrated by someone who locked those animals up knowing they were going to set that house on fire. The question many people have had, including me, is what was going on with Dory during the time the assailants were spreading the accelerant, locking up the pets, closing all the windows, and igniting the flames. The smart money says she was incapacitated at this point, or maybe dead. No one who knew Dory believed she would have gone quietly. So obviously something went wrong that night. The theories here could be endless. Maybe Dory caught one of the men trying to steal something. Maybe one or both of them wanted to sexually assault her. They sneak into her bedroom after she's gone to bed, and a big struggle ensues. Maybe this is when the baseball bat from next to her bed goes missing, or when the rifle is pulled from the closet and broken into two pieces. Either way, it seems likely that after Dory is either badly injured or outright killed, the cover-up goes into action. They want to act fast, they want to destroy evidence of their involvement, and they want to get the hell out of there. If that is the case, then why do they not leave until 3 a.m.? What were they doing in that house for several hours? Maybe things had gone well for a while before they got out of control. Or maybe, for the majority of the time that they were in that house, they were harming or had already killed Dory. So, they don't know if someone might come by in the morning or if someone has a key. They can't just hang around in the house waiting for the right time to get away. So instead, they do what seems most easy. They wrap Dory up in her own blanket and put her in the trunk of the Corolla. They then go into the house, spreading flammable liquids and picking up anything they may have left behind. Then, they ignite the blaze and go out into the garage. Moments later, they're driving off in Dory's car. Here's the thing, though. These clearly were not experts. Setting a house on fire, despite what you may see in movies, is not an easy thing to do. Even with the use of an accelerant, you have no way of knowing how the fire will spread or if it will burn out. The sheer fact that all of the windows were closed speaks of a lack of knowledge of how fire works, since the better the flow of oxygen, the stronger the fire is going to burn. Mostly, the areas which were destroyed by fire were the ones which had the accelerant directly applied to them. While the television was melted, the videotapes beneath it were fine. It seems pretty clear that the killers wanted the whole house to go up, but they overestimated their efforts. So what happens next? We can't be certain, But less than 3 hours later, Dory's car is found burning in the middle of nowhere just west of Lake Okeechobee. The drive from Dory's home to where the car was found is approximately 76 miles southwest. The most direct route was via Florida 70 and 78 east, with the total driving taking approximately between 1 hour and 20 minutes and 1 hour and 35 minutes. So, if they had driven directly to the spot where the car was found, they should have arrived between 4:30 and 5 a.m. However, the fire isn't called in until nearly an hour later, which suggests that somewhere between Dory's house and that rural boat launch, the car made another stop. Some believe the killers proceeded to another location where they had left their car. One followed the other down to the boat launch, they lit the car on fire, and then drove off together. This spot where the car was found, I'm not kidding you when I call it the middle of nowhere. This is not a place you'd randomly stumble across. This is not a place you would just know about if you didn't have some knowledge of Florida geography. This makes many people believe that if these two so-called Marines were involved, at least one of them is likely from Florida or has spent a lot of time there. But here's another interesting detail. One of the men seen with Dory that night was described as possibly being of Native American ancestry. Curiously enough, the distance from the spot where Dory's car was found to the Seminole Reservation was less than 3 miles. We know that investigators went there after receiving a tip. They spoke with a man who they believed matched one of the composites. But apparently no other witnesses were able to select him from a lineup. Whether or not he was involved, we simply don't know, and no additional information has been released about him. Regardless, I think it's hard to ignore the possible connection there. I also know that when it comes to reservations, local investigators don't have much jurisdiction, if any. The facts seem clear. For these guys to have gotten away, there had to have been another car or a third person involved. Maybe someone who gave them a place to stay while the heat died down. Maybe someone who didn't even know they were involved in a crime, but knew them and figured they were just visiting. Either way, you're not walking away from that fire and going unnoticed, especially since the fire department responded as quickly as they did. Twice, in the same night, these guys set a fire that was called into 911 before it even reached its peak. Where they went from there, we simply don't know. Now, for some folks, the whole story about these alleged Marines sounds a little too far-fetched to believe. People have pointed out that while witnesses saw Dory with two identified men that night, no one knows for certain that they were Marines. No one saw Dory or the men leave, and so no one knows if they left together. For some, there is just as much likelihood that Dory took those two men home from the bar as there is that she may have seen two men hitching or holding up signs asking for money or help, injured veteran, etc., and just pick them up right there. Of course, you have to work with the composites. They're what you've got. But that doesn't necessarily mean all other options should be ignored. Let's take a moment to examine what we know for certain. Dory is seen at the bar with two men. Dory's house burns down. Dory goes missing. Dory's car is found 3 hours later, 80 miles away, also on fire. Those are the basic facts. The story about the Marines, about Dory offering them a place to stay, and everything else comes from her ex-boyfriend, Joe Jones. Jones stated that he spoke with her on the phone that night between 9:30 and 10, at which time she informs him that she'd brought the two guys home and made up beds for them. Joe, admitting that this annoyed him, says he tried to ask some questions and advised against this, but Dory rushed him off the phone. Taking a moment to pause here, I just have to ask, if you had just brought two men home to spend the night, even if it weren't sexual in nature, is that what you would tell your ex-boyfriend who calls you almost daily? It seems to me that given Dory had dated Jones for years, she may not have offered that information up so as not to inflict jealousy or a conflict. On the other hand, as some have theorized, maybe that was the entire point. Jones and Dory had been broken up for at least a month by this point. He'd moved out. And maybe Dory was a little tired of his calls, which some have described as checking in on her versus chatting. Now, there's a couple of things about Joe Jones which may or may not be important, but certainly appear to be relevant. The problem is, I can't verify them. The information comes directly from statements Donna Jean made on the Unfound podcast, and while I have no reason to question her words, I didn't feel right inserting them into the evidence section of this episode without independent verification. Given that rather robust and wordy disclaimer, I'm going to go into a few of the details here in the theory section, so long as it's understood we cannot verify these statements. At least, not yet. Donna Jean said she couldn't be certain when Dory and Jones had gotten together, but they had been together before somewhere between 5 and 10 years. Donna Jean stated that while she liked Jones and said he was a good guy who was often helping Dory out with one project or another, at the same time, she noted that while he was good, he could be a real mean drunk. Donna Jean said that her sister didn't speak too openly about her relationships, but did tell her that Jones had struck her at one point in time. While Donna Jean doesn't know exactly when or why the relationship ended, she didn't think it was over anything major, speculating that Dory had simply grown tired of the way things were and she wanted a change. The house on Salerno belonged to Dory, but Jones had moved in and lived with her during their relationship. Reportedly, when they met, Jones had been living with his father just a few blocks over, which had made things easy. By December of 2005, however, the relationship had ended and Dory was back to living alone. According to Donna Jean, her parents had planned to take Dory and Jones on a cruise that holiday season and had gone through with all of the preparations. Even though Jones and Dory were split, they were still friends and he'd already been cleared, so she brought him along on the cruise anyway. Now, on the night of the fire and Dory's disappearance, Jones says he spoke with her between 9:30 and 10 p.m. At the time, he was working as a truck driver and stated that he was in Missouri. At the conclusion of his call with Dory, he told her that he'd see her that weekend, as he would be making the drive back home. Well, that should be fairly easy to check, I'd imagine you're thinking. As it turns out, not so much. While investigators have never commented on it, Donna Jean made it clear that she'd never seen anything to confirm that Jones was outside of Florida that night. Several digs into his background showed documented ownership of a company entitled Joseph Jones Hauling. If indeed he worked for himself, then there may not be another method by which to confirm his whereabouts that night. Suffice it to say, Donna Jean expressed a lot of suspicion when it came to Jones. While she couldn't say with any certainty whether he was involved, she did believe that he wasn't being upfront with investigators and didn't appear to be heavily affected by Dory's disappearance. Donna Jean stated that within 24 to 48 hours of the fire, she stopped by Dory's house just to feel near her. When she walked in, she found Jones already inside. Donna Jean says he grabbed a small statue, one which Dory had given him as a gift, and a series of tapes from beneath the television and took them. She didn't know how long he'd been in the house and whether or not he'd taken anything else. If accurate, many people find this to be a highly suspicious detail. Digging around at the crime scene within 2 days, Donna Jean couldn't help but wonder if he was looking for something specific. Now, we veer into somewhat more of a sketchy area, but I think it's worth noting. Donna Jean said that she had been told by both law enforcement officers and Jones himself that he had been asked to take a polygraph on 2 separate occasions. According to Donna Jean, Jones failed the first one, but passed the second. She claimed that when she asked Jones about this, he told her that his father had advised him to take a Valium before that second test, and when he did that, he passed. Now, this is a highly controversial statement because I could not get confirmation from any source, including law enforcement, that they ever polygraphed anyone in this case. To be fair, I was not told no. I was simply told that that was an area of the investigation they could not discuss. Strangely, Donna Jean makes a statement that I think displays a certain level of cognitive dissonance, which is to be understood given the extreme stress and grief she experienced. On the one hand, she notes, Jones didn't seem all that broken up about Dory's loss. At the same time, she says she believed that Jones was not over Dory, and in her opinion, he'd still have been with her if that was an option. While I can look at that as a conflicting description coming from Donna Jean, it could also be a mildly accurate representation of someone who's in the complexities of post-relationship emotions, both loving and hating their ex. When it comes down to it, Joe Jones is kind of like those 2 Marines. We don't know enough to say he certainly couldn't have been involved, but we don't know enough to say that he had to have been either. You can speculate all day long about the possibilities, that the two Marines were people he knew and he used Dory's soft spot for military members to trick her. That the two Marines did exist, but Jones didn't know them, and that the arguing heard between midnight and 2 a.m. was actually Joe showing up at Dory's house, throwing them out, and then getting into a violent rage with Dory herself. There's also the chance that the Marines were completely made up, at least in terms of them being at her house. It wouldn't be hard to set up the couch and pull out the bed to make it look like they'd actually been there. At the same time, this all seems like a hell of a lot to go through, especially if we are to believe that this is a snap decision made in moments of jealousy and anger. I'm certainly not saying you should look in the opposite direction of Jones. Frankly, the most recent ex-boyfriend would usually rank high on someone's list of potential suspects. And while I think there's enough gaps there to elicit interest, I just don't see enough evidence to point a finger. Perhaps that's why this case remains in the state it is, because without something more, there's very little to be done. Finally, moving away from Jones, we have a potential boyfriend who is more of a mystery than a man at this point. According to Donna Jean, in the months leading up to her disappearance, Dory had begun seeing a guy who lived in the Fort Myers area. With the two living on opposite coasts with nearly 200 miles between them, the relationship was vastly more long distance than not. However, Donna Jean claimed that the two had been to each other's homes and that this mystery man may have even have taken care of Dory's pets while she was on that cruise in December, just weeks before her disappearance. Obviously, without knowing more about this guy, it's pretty difficult to analyze his potential involvement. However, there is one detail which I think is interesting and worth noting. After the fire, after Dory's disappearance, when her name was in all the headlines, television shows were discussing her case, and family members were blanketing the country in missing persons flyers, this guy never came forward. He never contacted the family to share in their grief or offer his support. He never reached out to investigators as someone who knew Dory and may have had insights into what could have happened and her state of mind at the time. To me, there's really only a handful of possibilities here. Either this guy doesn't exist, or he does and may have been involved in the crime, or perhaps he's married and doesn't want to out himself as cheating on his wife. Someone's house has been torched, their pets killed, their car taken and burned, and they're still missing. You would think that would be enough to encourage someone to come forward, unless, of course, they have something to hide. As some people have pointed out, Lake Okeechobee is on the way to Fort Myers. The last angle I'm going to explore here is, for lack of a better term, niche. It's not something I've seen discussed publicly. It's not something I've seen investigators address. It's just something that I came across and thought could be interesting, but could also be nothing. According to Donna Jean, after returning from the cruise, Dory embarked on another trip in the latter half of December. She flew down to Belize in South America with a friend named Jimmy Lee. Donna Jean didn't go into great detail here, but did express that she thought something about that trip may have been off. All that she'd say was that while Dory was excited to tell her about the trip and to show her pictures, she got a weird vibe. She said that Dory had traveled through a lot of small airports and may have seen something she shouldn't. It may require some reading between the lines, but it very much gave me the suggestion of something connected to drugs or drug trafficking. Perhaps Dory saw something or someone she shouldn't have. The reason this story about Belize is as of any interest to me is because Belize has a high level of drug trafficking which occurs from the outright shipping of cocaine to precursor chemicals used in the production of certain drugs. While it may all be just a grand coincidence, Dory did face a charge in 1990 of possession of cocaine, as did her husband, Stephen Myers. According to a local report at the time, police officers pulled over their vehicle, at which time they found cocaine and drug paraphernalia. Now, does that mean Dory was involved in some kind of drug trafficking? Certainly not. But it does open the door to the possibility that Dory may have known people who were involved in the sale or procurement of cocaine. Many people have pointed out that Dory's traveling companion on this trip, Jimmy Lee, died approximately 6 months after she vanished in a motorcycle accident. Does that add up to something more than a juicy detail which may be completely unrelated? That's hard to say. I could keep pulling on this thread all day, but unfortunately, it's just never going to lead me anywhere without more information. And that's what this case mostly comes down to, doesn't it? A severe lack of information, witnesses, evidence, and answers. Dory Myers vanished more than 17 years ago, and all this time later, we're still asking the same questions, looking in the same places, and considering the same circumstances. Very little has changed, few developments have evolved, and almost no leads have panned out. Dory's family knew how important it was to keep her name in the headlines, because you just never know who could be reading that day and realize something they thought they'd forgotten. Someone out there knows what happened that night in January of 2006. Unfortunately, unless someone comes forward, new evidence is uncovered or Dory herself is recovered, the disappearance of Dory Ann Myers will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Dory Ann Myers, there are many websites and forums discussing her case. The most helpful sources for this episode came from the Orlando Sentinel and the St. Lucie News Tribune. I also want to say that you should definitely check out Donna Jean's full interview on the Unfound podcast. The link is in the show notes. If you have any information about the disappearance of Dory Ann Myers, please contact the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office at 772-462-3353. Her case numbers are 01-SMP-1206 and 1-06-000-459. You can also call Treasure Coast Crime Stoppers at 1-800-273-8477 or submit tips on their website at tcwatch.org. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. At this time, I'd like to take a moment to thank our amazing Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Andrew Guarino, Anne Bertram, Camelia Tyler, Christine Greco, Danny Renee, Daerthy, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eloanne Meyer, Fabulous TT, Guillerme Pinto, Jennifer Winkler, Julie A. Mangano, Justin Snyder, Kara Moreland, KY, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Madison Lehoulier, Marla Wright, Melissa Brekeisen, Nick Mohar Shores, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tiffany Nelson, and Tom Radford. Without your amazing support, this show would not be possible. So thank you all so much for contributing to Trace Evidence. One quick reminder, if you're planning on attending CrimeCon this year in Orlando, Florida, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com to save 10% off your pass. Once again, that's promo code TRACE at crimecon.com. If you're interested in learning more about this case or other cases featured on the show, please visit trace-evidence.com. There you can find case breakdowns, all social media links, merchandise shops, case descriptions, media, and options for donating, including PayPal and Patreon, should you wish to support the show. This concludes our look into the disappearance of Dorianne Myers, at least for now. I'll be sure and drop an update should law enforcement supply me with more information. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.